This is the second part.
I'm sure most of you are familiar with Velázquez Las Meninas. I'm sure you all have seen it. The reason why I wanted to briefly talk about this painting is because it is often considered kind of like the pictorial equivalent of Calderón's Life is a Dream, because it also deals with illusion and reality. It's probably one of the most enigmatic, one of the most puzzling paintings there is. And it deals with different levels of reality, too. Can you tell me what they are or why this is the case? What do we see on this painting? Yes, please?
Is that supposed to be Velázquez?
Yes.
Uh-huh. So, I mean, we have a painter. Mm-hmm. With the canvas with his back to us and paintings in the background while we're looking at, mm-hmm. painting mm-hmm. what we're looking at, I guess. Mm-hmm. So, layers within layers.
Yes, please. Were you going to say something or?
Oh, no.
Oh, sorry, I thought you were.
So there's a mirror.
Yes, there's a mirror in there.
So theoretically, the painting is repeating through infinity, I guess, because it's facing the canvas,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. So in the mirror, we see the king and the queen facing us. So
yeah. You've also got. I mean, I'm not really sure what the artist is painting, but if it is that girl in the middle, then you've got people actually looking at the girl. Mm-hmm. Then you've got the two adults like in the back looking at the painting.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the girl in the front next to the dog. Looks like she's looking at the viewer.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've got us trying to figure out what to look at. whether it's the mirror or even the guy walking in. Like, it's sort of
mm-hmm.
the way that the painting works is that there's you look at how people respond to what they're looking at, I guess. And you don't really know what it is you're supposed to see.
Yeah. Yeah, we are kind of in the same position as the king and the queen. So are these characters looking at us? What are the king and the queen looking at, and where are they? Are they on the picture that he is painting, and is he painting them, or is he painting the scene that we are seeing here? That raises all sorts of questions.
Well, that's what I was going to say. You don't know what he's painting. I mean, depending on your viewpoint, he's painting the children, or he's painting the king and the queen,
mm-hmm.
and the kids are just in there while he's painting it.
Right.
And then who's that guy looking in the door, you know?
Mm-hmm. And of course, the question is he painting the king and the queen who are standing where we are standing looking at that? Or is he painting the scene that we're seeing, including himself? And in that case, are the characters in the picture, are they themselves looking into a mirror? Which would then explain why he can't, because, I mean, he's behind them, so why can he paint them from the front if they're behind them? So that would suggest that there is a big mirror that they're all looking into. So in that case, we would kind of be the mirror image of the... So, there, I mean, there's all these different levels of reality, all these questions that this image raises about. What is the real image? What is an image? Are these images, are these the real figures? Are these mirror images? And so on. Let's finally get to the text itself. I already mentioned that the date of composition is not quite clear, and there are also several editions of it, so there's really no original play. There are two first editions that was collected by his brother. And it was also collected by another guy who edited several other plays. And then there was another edition that was kind of edited, corrected by a friend of his, which is very different. And but people, for a long time, people took that to be the real play. So it's only been fairly recently that people have reconstructed what might be closer to an original version. What we have now is, yeah, what people think might be the closest we have to an original, but we will never know what really the original is, but this is the closest that they could get to something that was actually performed in Calderon's time. Before we start discussing the text, I wanted to just talk about the metrics a little bit, because that is something that that you don't really notice immediately, and something that also is different in Spanish, obviously, than in the edition that you are reading. Although this edition really does a pretty good job in trying to reproduce the metric changes. I've already mentioned that in the Commedia, one of the main innovations was that they use different metric forms depending on the situation, depending on the character, depending on the mood that they wanted to convey. So these are all the different meters that Calderón uses in the Commedia, and some of them are very typical Spanish meters. The most prevalent one is the romance form. It's kind of the all-purpose verse form that goes for all sorts of situations. He often uses it for soliloquies, for long interior monologue, and they're all written in octosyllables and eight-feet verses. And the second and the fourth lines have assonant rhymes. Assonant rhymes are, as opposed to consonant rhymes, are also called impure rhymes. A consonant rhyme is where the consonant rhymes, like rhyme and chime. An assonant rhyme is where only the vowels rhyme. So you might have an E and an A in one word, and an E and an A in the other word, but the consonants don't rhyme. So you really only you don't hear that there is a rhyme immediately. You really have to pay very close attention to that. So anyway, that's the second and the fourth. So this really sounds more like a free verse form there. It doesn't sound immediately like there is much of a rhyme here. And then the first and the third lines, they don't rhyme at all. So there's really a very little rhyme. So it sounds more like an everyday colloquial verse form. Then we have, let's look at an example that we have here. In the first act, scene 3, if I could direct you to that. This is the first time in the drama that we have the romance form. This is the Clotaldo, Rosaura, and Segismundo talking. So the English version here reads Tower Guards.
Which page are we?
Oh, this is page 10.
Right.
Page 10. So this is the beginning in this play. Well, this is the first time that the romance meter occurs. Before that, we had other meters. So Clotaldo says, Tower Guards, are you asleep or simply faint of heart? Your negligence let travelers gain access to the prison yard. I don't know what to think or feel, my jailkeeper Clotaldo's men. When will my sorrows ever end? I guess the English version does try to keep some rhyme there. I think in English the assonant rhyme is a little harder to do. But anyway, the scene and much of the rest is in the romance meter. Then we have the redondillas. They are used mostly for...
No, is romance also used for normal dialogue?
Not for quick changing dialogue, but yeah, for some... Yeah, like here we do have some dialogue that is in the romance meter.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not just the longer pieces. So the redondillas, they're used mostly for rapid dialogues, for rapid, quick exchanges between characters, and also for shorter interior monologues, short meaning less than like 25 lines. The redondillas are four lines dances with octosyllables, the 8 feet meter, and they can have both either assonant or consonant rhyme. It's usually the ABBA form. One example is Act 2, Scene 3. And I should have written down the...
That'd be page 41?
Page 41, thank you. Yeah, I should have written down the pages, that would have been easier. Did I say Act 2, Scene... 42, right? So here we start out with a short interior monologue by Segismundo, and then we go into these quick lines between the second servant and the first servant. So here with Segismundo we have, God save me, what is this? What's this I perceive? God help me grasp what I've seen here. I'm awed and not untouched by fear, but can't be sure what to believe. And then on the next page we have this exchange between between him, the second servant, the first servant, where we have this quick exchange between the characters, and that's what the redondillas are usually good for. Then we have the quintillas. They're also used for rapid dialogue. Quintillas, quinto, they're five line verses, also eight syllables, and they have usually two consonant rhymes, but they can be distributed anywhere over those five lines, so there's no strict rule about where those rhymes have to be. An example for this is Act 1, Scene 5 and 6. That's page 17 is the beginning. In scene 6, page 20, that's probably a good example too. Here we have a quick exchange between Estella and Astolfo. And when King Basil comes in, he starts out with the quintilla meter, but then it changes to the romance meter, which is more suited to the lengthy monologue that he has there. Then we have the decimas. They're regarded to be particularly suitable for plaintive speeches, like the one by Segismundo at the beginning. Also for most of Segismundo's soliloquies are in that. It's a 10-verse stanza with eight syllable lines, Dr. Silva. And the rhyme scheme is ABBA, ACC, DDC. And that's a fixed meter. And his first soliloquy is a good example. That's verses 102 and the following. On page 5, when he goes, O abject wretch, to bear such misery, I struggled heaven's night and morn to comprehend what poet crime was perpetrated at the time when I offending you was born. So these are the decimals. Okay, then we have the octavas. There's really just one instance in the play that uses octavas. It's considered a very weighty, very kind of a heavy verse form. And it's here used at a moment of special gravity, which is when the king hears about the outbreak of war and he is commenting it. This is Act 3, Scene 5. That's verses. So that's King Basil and Astolf are talking here about the beginning of the war. Good Astolf, who can stop a bolting horse and still its rage into serenity, or check a surging river's headlong course before its waters flow into the sea? And so on. We can see these lines are a little bit longer. But I think the translation doesn't quite make that clear here. But anyway, those are the octavas. And then the last poem is the silvas, mostly used for lyrical, passionate, descriptive speech. They are a hybrid verse form. They're either 7 feet or 11 feet long. And feet. And so in this play, they're especially associated with Rosaura, who's also kind of a hybrid person. She's both a man and a woman, and they're kind of used to highlight this hybrid nature of her character. So they're often associated with her. And at the very beginning of the play is in Silvas. So her very first soliloquy is a good example of that. And you can see the translation too has different. Here we have, I think, the usually either 10 or 6 feet lines in the English translation. In Spanish, it's 7 versus 11 feet length. The translation does a good job of emphasizing this different line length, which is important, because the others are usually all regular 8-syllable lines. All right, do you have a question for Paul about this? All right, I would actually like to, maybe we could go to...
Sorry, did you make it go away?
Where are the questions that we...
Oh, the questions. I think they're down at... Well, they're what? To the right. One of those to the right.
Yeah, can we make this smaller?
Well, if you want to.
I would like to maybe begin by letting you talk a little bit about the characters. So perhaps you could assign like different people different characters so that we talk about, start out with a bit of a character analysis. And I would like you to look at how they're represented in the soliloquies, how they represent themselves in their soliloquies, but also their interaction with other characters, their function in the play, why are they there at all, their development throughout the play. Is there a change? Do they change? What is it that do they learn? Do they develop? And so on. So yeah, maybe we could. I don't know. I mean, you could do that on your own or with and discuss it in groups. Whatever you want to do. But maybe we could just assign different people, different characters. Let's see. Sigismundo, volunteers. Sigismundo, our hero. You guys. Rosaura. Rosaura, anybody? Rosaura. Rosaura, okay. You all there? Are you with her? Okay, good. Let's see. King Basil. Basilio. Any volunteers? Back there? Okay, back there. Back there we have Basilio. Let's see, we could... Clotaldo. He's an important guy. Clotaldo. Any volunteers? Okay, that side gets Clotaldo. All of you guys there. Clotaldo. And then we have Astolf and Stella. Whoever doesn't have a character yet has Astolf and Stella. Okay? All right, so you can talk or you can not talk. It's up to you. You can talk or think, whatever you want to do. Come up with some an interpretation and analysis of these characters, who they are in the play, what their function is, their development, and all that. Okay? Maybe 5 minutes, and then we'll come together again. Like 5 or 10 minutes. Yeah, make 5. Okay, go.
Okay, so what is whatever you want?
No, it's either 7 feet or 11.
It alternates
between 7 and 11.
Okay. Yeah. 7 and 11 because it's actually, did the odd lines in and feminine in this?
Yeah, I think so.
So it's like saying 6 and 10.
6 and 10 in English, yes.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you can, it doesn't matter, you can put them wherever you want. The 6 and 11.
I really want the line of 7 and 11. No, that's good. Yes, it's pretty strong.
Well, so they continue doing tragic comedy kinds of things for the entire 7th century, 16th century.
Which is.
When they didn't go through the classical period.
Yeah.
They didn't say it good.
That was really
the
hall
they
were doing.
Mm-hmm. Where did they come up with?
Yeah, the prison guard.
Where did they come up with this misconception?
I'm not sure. I guess
it's
a
very
limiting. I don't know. I guess he just somehow developed it.
Yeah.
the side of that tree, there's another beauty of the kind of place.
So this is already an issue, I suppose.
I circled it.
Already,
well, when he wrote this, ultimately that community,
yeah, right.
That was also kind of a defense to the authorities, to as an explanation of why he was doing what he was doing.
And he talks about free will.
But there's always the example of space.
He says that.
Even so. Certainly.
Yeah.
And then what's the connection with what's
going on?
I think more in art than in English, and perhaps also more poetry than the drama.
That's for the drama.
Are you still on that same soliloquy?
In Spain,
yeah. It's the second one.
And I gather maybe.
I think, as far as I know, German writers didn't read Lenz until Goethe was considered a sort of the romantic poet of writers really like about the novel. But he really wasn't resuscitated until Lenz, I think. Well, I guess after the world, there was a kind of reaction against the world, and people just really didn't like that for a long time.
One of the things I was thinking is
Hugo von Hofmann's town wrote a story that's more of a tower. Really exactly the same story. Basically, very, very closely based on my
language.
Very funny.
Oh, very good to begin with that film. It's, I have seen. I've seen both films.
Oh, really?
Well, I should watch this one. It's actually quite good.
I've never seen the last guy.
Of course, yeah. Yeah. Well, yes.
What? How is this so different?
Well, I guess I'm
crazy. Yeah. Which makes everything good.
Well, he has a mask. It's funny, I was trying to remember about the mask. He looked better. Yeah, when he was in his third state, he looked better with the mask off. The mask is really scary. His face is just one person. So, that's kind of very, very nice.
Yeah, but I think it's really interesting, all these references to the
DNA. Over and over again, my gosh, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
So then that's not the true experience.
I will go for some places. You ought to be able to do that side by side.
Oh, really?
And do that up in, I don't know, not preferences, but maybe. Let's see. Oh, this is preview.
I have like
oh, this isn't. this isn't, this isn't, it's not, I was expecting it to be Adobe. No, it's a preview thing, but we still might be able to do it. This PDF is single page, two pages. Two pages can be. No, I don't like that.
The other one?
Yeah. Well, no, it's like two pages. Well, it's only getting a good stat, and then there are four pages in all. Why won't they have one, two, three, four?
Yeah, this is not a problem. I actually had only one page.
Oh, but I made it bigger.
Oh, right.
Yes, I'm sorry. What did they call it? Maybe they say the quiet. I'm not sure what this is here. Oh, there we go. Still.
Well, then maybe go back to
the
before.
We could make it smaller. I think. I'm still not giving it to you. This is ridiculous. Well, they're the characters. I'll be able to do percentages, but well, that's not so bad. This is frustrating.
All right, let's start with Series Mundo. What do our Series Mundo specialists have to say?
Specialists have 5 minutes. We're experts on this.
Yes. Oh, thank you.
Well, we just started at the beginning of who he was. He's the son of the king.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a prophecy that he's going to upset things, not rule well, and so he's in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And, but you find him in they say he's an animal cult. So it's almost mm-hmm. like he's not a man, he's a brute. And then mm-hmm. it kind of furthers that one because he's because he goes in the soliloquy like, you know, you can basically make me a man and I fall in love with you. Now I want to live. I, you know, I see a purpose to life. And, mm-hmm. and you will open my eyes to things that, like, you're my window to the world. Then it was only the jailer who told him his whole reality.
Mm-hmm.
Can everybody hear? You guys are getting
quiet.
How about if you guys come a little closer here? I hate to make you get up, but maybe this.
Or speak louder.
Maybe that would work. If we'd all come a little closer.
Sitting in the front, I can't hardly hear.
Well, you done or?
His whole worldview is based on what, I guess, what Paulo had said mm-hmm. and what he had observed in nature.
Mm-hmm.
He said he had learned about politics from watching the beasts mm-hmm. and the birds and all of that, so that's kind of interesting. That,
well, that's all he was educated, yes.
He was educated. Well educated. Just from observation and from what he was told by one person. Basically.
And, well, but in books, I
well, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
yeah. But then it also comes into play, like, he's... He becomes king at the end, but only because people now view him as being able to be king.
Mm-hmm.
So the view of others.
Mm-hmm.
And then even at the end, like he imprisons the jailer, mm-hmm. I mean, he imprisons the rebel who actually freed him the second time after
yeah.
he's thrown back. And people, you know, I read some criticism because I was just like, why is that or whatever. And they said some people believe that that's because it shows that he is actually worthy to be king because
mm-hmm.
a king must put rebels or who are viewed to be rebels in jail
mm-hmm.
and so then to be the good king to take on that role even though that man freed him personally
mm-hmm.
he must for the kingdom
mm-hmm. he was the
jail.
Yeah. Okay, more about Philip Munro.
Improving himself, honorable in the view of others, I guess. Mm-hmm. We were talking about the importance of what honor was, and sort of mm-hmm. part of it was how others view you, by not taking his father's life when he could have, and sort of offering his own life, at least with his words, you know, to his father, laying his life down, you know, in front of him, basically. Mm-hmm. And then doing the honorable thing by letting Rosario marry Estol. You know, people, the two that really loved each other, allowing that. And
did they really love each other?
They supposedly.
Well, they were betrothed.
Yeah, the two that were promised to one another originally, and then taking Forstella. So he tried to appear honorable in those situations.
What about him at the beginning of the play? We talked about more about him at the end of the play. What about the beginning?
Say he's well known. He was very beastly. He was in chains, and he was really living the life of a beast. He wasn't living the rational life. He was living much more the primal life in terms of how he viewed himself. And it was almost like when he met, was it Rosario?
Rosario.
Anyway, it was almost, we discussed that there was that whole beauty of the beast element in terms of she actually helped him to come out of his primal nature.
Yeah, she's an important element. And
he actually compares himself to a minotaur. He's like, I'm like a monster in a maze, which would be like a minotaur.
Yeah, yeah, that's an important image, isn't it? Yeah.
Through one of his soliloquies or speeches, he talks some about being undeserving, and that only through grace is he still alive. So there are several references.
Which one are you talking about?
One that begins with one line 190 in Act 1. Mm-hmm. He says in line 2, around 200, where I endure in wretched strife, a living skeleton stripped of life, a dead man only live by grace. Mm-hmm. In all my days I've spoken to one man and one alone. And later on in that same speech, around line 240, he says, "We'll grasp life's harsh finality. Why grant life to a wretch like me when happy mortals can be slain?" Mm-hmm. And in the margin, I just wrote, he seems to feel undeserving of being here, but he feels there's got to be a reason that he's still here. And so, as they were saying a minute ago, when he meets Rosaura, I think he begins to think, oh, maybe there's connection, which I think one of your questions alludes to. What is the connection between Rosaura's camouflage and the cave in which Segismundo lives?
Yeah, maybe we could talk about that later on, but about his, why is he in this state that you just now described? Why does he feel so dejected? Why does he talk about life the way he does?
He's been deprived, because he has no life.
Yeah,
he's exactly. Locked up in jail.
He has no life, and he considers that also goes again with the concept of honor, and they say that a couple of times in the play, a life without honor is no life. A life without honor is death, and that is what he considers his life to be. And one of the quotes that you just mentioned, a living skeleton stripped of life, a dead man only lived by grace. We have this both the parallelism of the line and then this oxymoron to the oxymoron. Are you familiar with that? That speech.
Oxymoron.
Oxymoron,
is that
what
it is?
Oxymoron, sorry.
Yes.
Sorry.
Thank you.
What is that?
It's kind of like a paradox. It's kind of, it's two things that are seemingly unalike that actually make the other one make sense.
Right, like we have your living skeleton, a skeleton is not alive, but it emphasizes the way he feels about his condition as really not being alive and yet obviously breathing but not having a life here. And that is an image that is repeated throughout the play. And a little further on, we have here too, I'm a man of a beast and a beast of a man. So both an oxymoron and also kind of a chiasmic structure. I'm not pronouncing that right. chiasmus, where we have the man, the beast of man, this structure. And those are figures of speech that are repeated again and again throughout the play. what about, did you talk about his first soliloquy at all? The first soliloquy? Did you guys talk about that?
There was a lot of reference to the cosmos and his repetition of, should I enjoy less liberty? Sort of started talking about that and then got off on something else. He mentions two beasts and stream, two fish and birds, so another reference to beasts and animals.
He mentions that he has free will, but he's not free to use his free will.
Right, exactly. And he's... But he is being very rational, very reasoning. He is giving several examples of why other beings, lower than mankind, have the liberty that he is lacking. But he's just describing himself as not living, as being a beast of man, as not being really alive. He is using his reason, his rationality, to an incredible, incredibly well-developed form. He's giving all these elaborate explanations of different things that have what he doesn't have, what he's lacking. Also the parallelism that you mentioned here. What about his, one of my questions was too about his development in the play. What do you think, is there a turning point, or what do you think, how can we describe his development? Because I think it's more of a gradual conversion than a one point turning around. Can you trace that?
Wouldn't it be, he found a way to live life with honor, so mm-hmm. therefore he did that, but yeah. I think when he first gets out of prison and goes, when he sees his mm-hmm. father and he gets all enraged, mm-hmm. It's almost like his feelings, his emotions have taken over him, just like almost like an animal, like when you meet him and the animal pelts, mm-hmm. It's like that takes over that primal instinct.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like he needs to learn to control that, see that going back there
mm-hmm.
will give him what he so desires in the beginning, which is to live a life with honor mm-hmm. and not to be the living skeleton.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he has to come to terms with his father and his, all of that
mm-hmm.
in order to realize that that's how he's going to live a life with honor, is to
Good.
Be the king.
Yeah. And what are parts of this process? What are the different steps in the course of the drama that we, what we see him beginning to turn around, or beginning to learn. I mean, you already mentioned Rosalba, his realization of a woman's beauty is probably the first step here. But at this point, he is still a beast of a man. He's still not anywhere close to his conversion. But what are the other steps? Yeah.
When he goes back to prison after
mm-hmm.
they said it was a dream.
Mm-hmm.
He's questioning, was it a dream?
Mm-hmm.
Did I really live this? Was I imagining it?
Mm-hmm.
Just questioning everything that was going
mm-hmm.
on.
Good.
And then when he goes back to the situation,
mm-hmm.
to the court,
yeah.
and he sees Rosara, and, oh, this really did happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's the realization of the dream becoming reality
mm-hmm.
in his brain.
Mm-hmm.
And then the realization of finding honor with what other people think about him, and doing the honorable
mm-hmm.
thing,
mm-hmm.
not only in actuality, but in
mm-hmm.
appearance
mm-hmm.
as well.
Like laying down his, like she said, like laying down his, or saying that he would, that his father could kill him now, you know, I would
mm-hmm.
lay down my life. Pack off my head.
That is also a very famous, very interesting soliloquy. What page is that on again? The soliloquy that she just mentioned, where he realized that even in dreams we have to act well.
Line 2010, supposing that it was a dream,
with all the here is what mm-hmm. I deem occurred,
yeah.
not just in my mind. Awakened yesterday to find myself, this taunts me, lounging in the bed so bright it might have been the flowery cot by which the spring adorns the earth in coloring from all the hues contained therein. So
mm-hmm.
would be the
yeah, theme, yeah.
questioning if it's a dream
mm-hmm.
or not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's take a look at this whole scene. What is it, 19? This whole scene is his soliloquy here. Let's look at that a little more closely, if you'll count that. Act 2, scene 19, page 78 and 79. Okay. So Plotado has just told him that that this might have been a dream, but even in a dream, we have to act honorably. And so this is one of the part of the learning process that he's undergoing. And here he is, this is central in that he's talking about the relationship between reality and dream and really life as dream. Okay, especially the last part here, what do you think about that? Oh, the last part of the soliloquy, especially when he's talking about this line, 2175. In fact, all mortal souls on earth dream their conditions from their birth, though no one knows this to be true. I'm dreaming now that darker days await me, chained in this dark cell, and so on. What's life? A frenzied, blurry haze. What's life? Not anything, it seems. A shadow. Fiction filling dreams. All we possess on earth means nil, for life's a dream, think what you will. And even all our dreams are dreams. Probably the most famous lines of this play. Summarizing the...
Does anyone ever really know what reality is?
Mm-hmm.
I mean... They don't talk about the afterlife or what happens after you die as like they did in the Renaissance. There was a lot
mm-hmm.
of talk about that. I don't see that so much here. But all these authors, especially the ones you were showing us before,
mm-hmm.
keep talking about is, you know, kind of what are we doing here on Earth,
mm-hmm.
and does any of it, it goes by so fast, and all we possess on Earth means nil, which is nothing, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So are the things we own, our possessions really anything, or is it maybe going back to the honor? Is that really what's
mm-hmm.
of more value? I'm just thinking aloud
yeah,
right
yeah.
now. I don't know.
Yeah, but I mean, there's really a deep questioning of really what life is and what the reality status of life is and what reality means and how we know what life or what reality is. And not just that life is nothing, but really the question of how do we know what it is, or how can we ever be sure about who we are? He's talking here about how everybody, all mortal souls on earth, dream their conditions from their birth. So we create the reality that we have. We are what we think we are, what we want to be, or really what we think we are. But in doing so, we're creating our own reality. But this might not be really reality. Just like
the power of the mind.
Yeah.
Like,
mm-hmm.
oh, you know, the mind
mm-hmm.
over matter. Like, you
yeah.
create your own reality,
mm-hmm.
how you view the world.
Yeah.
Your,
mm-hmm. So that's really kind of a very fundamental crisis, too, of the mind, because it people, I mean, this is basically the reason for the kind of the pessimism that that is underlying, to some extent, a lot of this drama, because by questioning everything and by considering everything to be really nothing, or by having the possibility that there's really nothing behind it, that's really a very fundamental crisis too, fundamental instability of.
Well, then it also questions like, how does he pull himself out of this
mm-hmm.
state to realize it? I mean, if life's a dream, if everything's
mm-hmm.
worth nil, then
mm-hmm.
what's the point of living an honorable life,
mm-hmm.
which
yeah.
is what he thought that he was supposed to do in the
yeah.
first place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The soliloquy begins with how very true
mean, it's a logical argument that you can't say it's false. The dream, there's, you know, so it does actually seem like he's trying to get at, like, what can we at least say?
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that he goes to dreams, so, like, it's almost like he can understand, he knows that dreams are dreams. He knows, like, when there's something that's false or made up or contrived, he can tell. When it's real, he can't necessarily say this is real for sure, but he can at least tell you when things are contrived. Which is interesting, too, because the king tries to set up a sort of false situation in order to see if his son is really going to be just or unjust. And
yeah.
So it's like he's trying to see the truth through a contrived false situation.
Experiment, yeah.
And, I mean, I don't know that this necessarily recommending it, but it maybe he's allowing this to be a sort of starting point.
He's what?
Allowing this to be a sort of starting point. Because, I mean, when you think about, well, everything could be a dream, I mean, you really get into just sort of these logical circles, and you don't know what to do. You kind of have to despair a little bit. But he does end up saying, we can at least say a dream is a dream.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that this is where he wants to end up. But I think that ending that allows us to sort of pull back and say, well, we can at least call something false, which says something about truth, even if it's not a very precise, thing about truth. Does that make sense?
So are you saying that this realization that, the realization that everything, that life is a dream, that dreams are dreams, is that what then makes him, is that what you're saying, that what makes him kind of turn around, come around?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess it's a different form of argument. Like, I guess when you're talking about God, a lot of times, like, you try saying what God is, and you realize you can't do that, so you say what he's not.
Yeah.
And so he's saying, like,
he's defining it by,
it's true, but I can at least tell you.
Yeah, defining it by the negative or by,
although, one question I have about this simply is, he says, Maya 21:5, he says, the insight life experience gives is that until men wakes, he lives a life that only dreams of triumph.
Mm-hmm.
How is he allowed to make any reference to life's experiences and the wisdom that it brings if life could just all be a dream? Like, I don't understand how he can argue from experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the experience, maybe he's referring to his own experience of realizing that you could always find out that you're dreaming, that what you experience is not an actual experience, but is a dream. Good. I don't know, what do you guys think? Yeah, good. I mean, yeah, maybe the reference to memory, that that you remember something as an experience. It was something that you experienced, even though it took place in a dream, even though it wasn't an actual experience. That doesn't convince you?
No, because, I mean, he has experience.
I don't know,
so they're just limited. Right.
Well, no, because I mean, the whole project he's undertaking is one that completely undercuts holding any value in things experienced or things known through this. I mean, it reminds me of Descartes, even. There's just this intense skepticism going on that doesn't really allow him. I mean, this may be convincing to someone who actually lives in the real world and knows that life is not just a dream, and you can actually learn from life's experiences, but for someone who really believes that all of life may just be a dream, but we're not even really sure about that, life experiences can't really have any force on it.
Yeah, but I mean, even in a dream, you experience things.
But it won't be about anything true, because a dream is a reality that's created.
Mm-hmm.
And so the rule truths are according to whatever you create, so it's not really according to truths.
That's true, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, they don't have true status in that. That's true.
But in following with the sort of argument of Descartes' meditation, in a sense it doesn't matter if it's wrong, right? Because in Descartes' argument, he takes you back and totally loses the entire external world altogether, because his skepticism is about a doubt that ceases to sort of reduce all of life to what we can be certain of. What Descartes says in the first or the second meditation, is that even if everything's fake, and I mean, it was his that was the original Matrix argument. He said there could be some evil genius God that's convincing us that everything's real, and it's not. And he says at the end of the day, it doesn't matter, because the one thing you can't take away is that I exist. Whether it's between this point and this point, it's oblivion before and after, or whether it's everything's fake. What you can't take away from the cogito argument is that even if it's all a dream, I still perceive it as a dream, which was the problem with the man in the film. They were telling him he doesn't exist, and he says, I can't not exist. I'm thinking about myself. You know, it's a paradox that can't compute.
Right.
Mm-hmm. In a sense, I think I understand that. If it's all a dream, fine, how do we know? But at the end of the day, it might be. Mm-hmm. Which is what I think Sigismund comes back and learns after his initial dream.
Good.
As his mentor or ethical guide, whatever his role is, as his character, as his card's character, that's telling him, hey, even if it all was a dream, you still acted foolish. Mm-hmm. And he learned some sort of ethical lesson.
Right.
So in a sense, whether it was fake or real, to him, it doesn't matter, because he knows that it was wrong, even if it was an imagined circumstance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe we could move on so that we can talk about the other characters briefly, and then, of course, we'll come back to, this is the central issue, of course, here, but let's maybe move to Rosaura, just to get a couple of other people here. To hear a couple of other people.
Well, our group did Rosaura, and she is really interesting. I mean, she begins the play, and her first line, she falls off a horse. So I mean, the play begins in a sort of chaotic falling. And who has not had a dream about falling? And the first thing she says is "Dash off, Wells," when she is talking to the horse. And so she immediately. Brings in, the fanciful or the dream world by referring to her horse as a hippogriff.
Mm-hmm. Good.
And then also she's dressed as a man at this point, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She's dressed as a man, so she begins by deceiving even the audience as to who she is.
Mm-hmm.
And then as the play moves on, so she. Changes her appearance so often. There's in scene 10 of the last act, there I thought was really helpful.
What page is that?
100-ish, I think. Yeah, 100.
Scene 10?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there we are. I thought that this was a very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, she does kind of recap a lot of what's going on in the parts that she decides to skip over.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like you can tell sort of what's important to her by seeing what she recounts. And what she does recount is, remember when you saw me and I was a guy, and then you saw me as a girl, and then you saw me this way and that way. And so she decides to point out all of her guys.
Mm-hmm.
And then his response is, just heavens, if it's really true, my dreams, or yes, it's been my memory, if it is possible for all I've seen to fit into a dream. So he's blown away by her, but it is funny, I guess maybe it's just comical that he his exclamation is just heavens. no man in such dire straits can pledge to aid a woman's honor when she looks the sight of loveliness. Which we said something about him and what he's how the visual perception impacts his actions, and then he almost has to retreat from the situation or from her in order to act in the way that he knows that he ought to act. But then also, I think what's revealed by this is that she, even though she carries a sword and she dresses as a man, she needs help in recovering her honor. Mm-hmm. Like, she seems almost to only be able to define herself by the way that she has other people perceive her.
Well, why does she end up coming to Sigismundo for help?
Because he's the one who can help her. Is he the only one that can kind of help her because of his status, because of his who he is?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's really the only one that can put her to restore her honor.
Who did she confide in first?
Clotaldo,
Why can't he help her?
Astolf saved Clotaldo's life,
mm-hmm.
but
it gets confusing.
He can't help her and hurt the one who helped him.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's in a quandary of what he should or should not do
mm-hmm.
based on perception of the situation.
Yeah, yeah. This poor man has really a lot of honor problems. Maybe we could talk about Clotaldo now. Who of you? Somewhere here? Clotaldo? Can you explain us all of Clotaldo's miseries and honor problems?
It seems like he represents legalism, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Because he originally went along with the king's order to imprison and I guess harass
mm-hmm.
The boy. Clearly this didn't arise from his own internal sense of morality, because when he's confronted with killing his daughter because she's seen the prince with
mm-hmm.
Her, he balks that. He's like, well, I can't do this, but the law demands that I do. And so it took something like that to kind of shake him out of this, like, legalistic mindset that he
mm-hmm.
had about everything up until then.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't... They don't really resolve that in the play either, because he always keeps getting out of it. Like, he's like, well, here they are, I'm going to have to kill them, right? And the king says, well, no, I'm just going to let him go anyway,
mm-hmm.
so you're off the hook this time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. And so I think what Calderon was trying to point out was that the rules, I guess, don't really have any intrinsic value either. They're kind of arbitrary at times, too.
Mm-hmm.
What
other honor problems does he have? So we have the first one where he realizes that she is she is his daughter, but at that point he doesn't know that she is a she.
Mm-hmm.
He thinks she is his son who has come there to avenge his honor. So his first honor problem is between his son and the king. Now then, what happens next? When does he realize that she is not a son?
I think she gives him a little riddle at the end.
Uh-huh, yeah. She
page 33.
She alludes to the fact that she is not a man. And so he realizes that she is his daughter, which makes his honor problem even more severe, because as her father, he is in charge of her honor, and he's in charge of restoring her honor. So then his honor problem gets increases even more by the fact that he realizes that she's a woman. And then we have the next step in his honor problem, the fact that the one who he should kill to save her honor is the one who saves his life. So then he has to choose between his daughter's honor, which is also his own family honor, and doing and acting against the person who saved his life, and who is his superior too, who is the Duke. So. And so this honor problem, he basically doesn't resolve it. He just tells her, well, I can't do anything now. I don't know what to do. I just can't. And that's why she is forced to confide, well, first to confide into the new king now, Sigismundo. And then at the end, what happens at the end with the marriage? So Sigismundo tells Astolfo, you have to marry her to make good.
Well, he doesn't want to marry her first until he realizes like who she is, and she actually has money, because at first
it's really only then that he reveals that she is his daughter, because he realizes that this is now the time that he can save her honor by revealing her true identity. But he really holds off, and probably wouldn't have ever said that if it hadn't been for this as enabling the marriage between the two. So he throughout the play he definitely puts his own honor and his own concept of honor above everything else. This is his driving motive throughout. He only reveals as much as he can without harming his honor. Let's just quickly go to Astolf and Stella, and we might also talk about Clarion a little bit. But what did you guys discuss with regard to these two characters? Why are they in the play at all? Somewhere in the middle there, am I right?
I actually wasn't sure why. I don't know. They just seem much more stagnant and shallow than the rest of the characters. Mm-hmm. And Astolf, maybe not as much as Stella, but because Astolf just seems like. Like, oh, I'm going to be king, so I'm going to marry you, Stella. And then he's like, oh, yeah, let's get your son back. That's fine. And then, he still is loyal to the king.
Mm-hmm.
At the end, he's like, okay, fine, I'll marry Rosara instead. Mm-hmm. She's noble, I can do that. And Stella's the same way. She just seems like she's like, okay, maybe I'll marry you as long as you get that portrait from your neck. And then later she's like, okay, he didn't do that, and somebody else is probably going to be prince, so I'll go after him instead.
Mm-hmm.
Then she's all happy because she's going to marry.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess we'll go. So.
Well, she lucked out too.
Yeah, she did.
Much more than Rosaura, who actually, who's forced to marry a person who obviously doesn't want to marry her.
Yeah.
Couldn't they be seen as like the opposite, those characters who don't try to live by honor, they just live by convenience, I guess? Like, what's most convenient for them? They don't really concern themselves with what's honorable. They're just like, okay, well, you know, I'll marry this person because this is going to get me more. It's like their own self-interest drives them more than honor. Like, because obviously if self-interest drove Sigismundo, he would have married Rosara, because that's...
Astolf would have married Rosara?
Would marry Rosara.
Yeah, why does he not marry Rosara?
Because it's honor. Because it's honor of being the king. It's honor of her originally having been promised to another man. It's whole honor thing. Where I would say Astolf and Stella don't put honor before self-interest. Like, Stella's happy. Ooh, I get to marry the prince, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So why would Astolf protect Clotaldo that one time when he fell at his feet?
Mm-hmm.
And that's it's an isolated incident, granted, but it was that one time. It's kind of the exception. I'm trying to figure that out.
But the way he does it, though, is more like, don't do that. You know, it's not like, oh, you're
Well, I think he does. I mean, they're drawing swords. They're beginning to have a sword fight. So I do think that he feels it his duty to protect.
Well, and that's what's interesting about his character, because it seems like he's like, yeah, bring your son in, but he's loyal to the king throughout the whole thing. So he fights on the king's side, and it's like he's protecting Clotaldo because of the king, because he's loyal to the king, mm-hmm. he's the king's servant. So I'm not... Really
Which does sure. have to do with honor, too.
Right, I mean, this it does have to
what,
do with honor.
What makes up his honor.
Though he doesn't seem to be... at least there doesn't seem to be a part where he's talking about, okay, I'm doing this because of my honor or whatever.
It seems to be more of a courtly honor, like this is the expectation, rather mm-hmm. than a personal honor of I'm doing
right.
this because I'm a good person. Or
right.
Because mm-hmm. it's the personally honorable thing mm-hmm. to do, but more like that's the court. Kind of like when we talked about Don Juan last week, how he was doing what was expected mm-hmm. of him, a courtier, mm-hmm. but not because he was an honorable
yeah.
character.
Seems like Kristoff is going through the motions. Mm-hmm. Not truly feeling it, like you were saying.
And not truly feeling the honor.
Yeah. Well, the selfish aspect certainly applies. I mean, he should have never started a relationship with Zara in the first place, because she didn't know, she didn't basically didn't have an identity, since she didn't know who her father was, and he knew that he never could have married a person without lineage. So, that was certainly very self-serving. Should have never gotten involved with her in the first place.
I may not have read Stella closely enough, but I did never really think she came off as selfish. I don't know how much say women in that time had, but I'm guessing not a whole lot. And mm-hmm. even though she was royalty, she probably still had to do what they told her to do. Mm-hmm. And so she was promised to this guy that still was wearing another woman's picture around mm-hmm. his neck, mm-hmm. you know, except for when she asked for it. It was mm-hmm. conveniently not mm-hmm. there, you know. And so I kind of felt bad for her. I thought mm-hmm. she was kind of pitiful because she was... Yeah. promised to this man to keep the royal line pure mm-hmm. and was stuck doing that, and then, you know, so she did kind of get the good deal in the end.
Yeah.
She didn't have to marry the selfish guy.
Yeah,
not that she wasn't selfish, but I didn't read her that
no,
way.
No, I don't, yeah, no, I don't think she, I think, no, I think the selfish part applies to Ethel. In some ways, maybe, I think Rosaura, too, I think she is probably much more of a selfish person. A self-centered person than Stella came across as. Yeah.
Stella kind of seems to be a victim of circumstance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All those circumstances ended up in her favor.
In the end, they did.
Gosh, how much time? Gosh, we don't have 10 minutes. Maybe in those 10 minutes, maybe we could just take a brief look at some of the imagery used in the play, different images associated with different characters or repeated motives, repeated language maybe too, what sort of linguistic or rhetorical features and elements are repeated. Yes?
Well, with Rosaura, she, I mean, the one who appears across the dress as something that she's mine, mm-hmm. Also identifies herself as being Rosaura, mm-hmm. and then also identifies herself with several possible characters.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So, she, like, with Diana, mm-hmm.
Yeah, uh-huh, yeah. Other images? References? I mean, mythology certainly plays an important role. We have the repeated motive, too, of Aeneas and Dido, and which is both applies to her as well as her mother, to whom the same thing happened.
I think I said earlier that Segismundo always refers to something in the stars, the planets, mm-hmm. and so there's mm-hmm. fate, yes, mm-hmm. that it was written to be so, or questioning, how
yeah.
can this be so?
Doesn't that go back to the original prophecy, which is the whole cause behind his situation?
Right, uh-huh. Yeah, we didn't really talk about Basilio, yeah, let's take a look.
I just made the connection of this is the original prophecy. Their prophecy caused the situation. He wrote it off to this is just the way life is going to happen, and I really have no control over it. And it's not until he steps up and says, you know what,
I am going to step out of my, I forget exactly how he words it, but basically out of my beastly state, and I'm going to take responsibility for my actions, even if this is a dream. I'm going to go ahead and make the right decisions because it's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And only then, once he takes responsibility for his own life, mm-hmm. is he able to be successful.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about Basilios? Why did he put his son into the tower for all of his life? And what do you think about that? Was that, I mean, what could he have done instead in order to prevent his son from becoming what the star said that he would become? How could he have handled this differently?
Succumb to fear. Fear of the unknown. Mm-hmm. Fear of the fate that was supposedly going to happen, and acted based on what something written in the stars said, mm-hmm. versus taking hold of the fate and making his own fate.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Just kind of went with it.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing that, when Sigismundo comes out from the cave for the first time, mm-hmm. fate becomes reality.
Yeah, yeah. But it's kind of paradoxical, because at first he thought that fate was what was going to happen, so you can't control fate, but then he tries to counter it by acting against fate, but of course then that gets completely
backfires
and fate takes over anyway, and yet it doesn't quite, because Sigismundo then proves that he can overcome his fate, and that you can still...
But that was them knocking him out, mm-hmm. again for the second time.
Right.
And again, mm-hmm. trying to tempt fate to work the way they mm-hmm. want it to work.
Mm-hmm.
And that time, it ended up in their favor.
Mm-hmm.
Where
yeah.
everyone ended up winning in the end.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a...
Yeah, somewhat of a disagreement, respectful disagreement. I do believe that he does try to take control of fate. I think he postures himself in the wrong way in doing so. Perhaps maybe educating the Prince of Virtue, teaching him good things rather than kind of throwing him in a mm-hmm. in a palace to be tormented,
mm-hmm.
Would have been a better way to prevent the entire.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's kind of hard to tell, like, how we're supposed to take the prophecy of the stars, like how reliable they are. If they are very reliable, then why would he throw him in prison unless it was a personal honor and he was worried about rather than the safety of his realm?
Mm-hmm.
If you were worried about the safety of his realm, he should probably kill his son or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, like not to put him in prison, like actually make him mind. Or if you're not really, because I mean, if, like, fate is fate, you know, no matter how you raise your kid, if that's how we're supposed to take it, then. No, I mean, kind of seems like he either should have trained him in virtue or killed him, but
in prison,
you know,
was like,
yeah.
But to kill him would damage his honor, I think.
Yeah.
That would be going against.
Well,
yeah,
unless that's only people.
Yeah.
I think this answers the question of why, that I just think it's ironic that in a story that has so much to do with other people's perception
mm-hmm.
and honor, so then it may even support the concept that other people's perceptions help shape our
mm-hmm.
sense of morality,
yeah,
if
uh-huh.
you want to call it that, then to remove him from other people's perceptions has almost guaranteed that he will have a sense of morality.
Right, uh-huh, right, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
Until he's stuck into the world, until he's
mm-hmm.
stuck encountering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, yeah, honor doesn't make any sense if you're on your own in a prison cell. There's,
right.
Yeah. Good. Shall we just call it quits for today?
Yeah.
All right. There's obviously a lot more to discuss here, but at least two of you are going to have the chance to develop that in further detail in your papers. Thank you very much. That was a lovely discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.